do anything first?
No.
Good morning. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Business and Labor to order this Friday, March 20th, the first day of spring.
Here, here. Spring into spring.
Looking at what we have on the agenda. Let's go ahead and start at the top, I guess. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 3244.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure provides that the borrower or its agent may rely on a lender's payoff statement for the purpose of establishing the amount that the borrower pays to satisfy their obligation under the real estate agreement, unless that borrower delivers an amended payoff statement. It provides that the lender may recover an amount from the borrower that the borrower owes that did not appear on the payoff statement only as unsecured debt or by foreclosing other property that secures the obligation. It defines what a payoff statement is and declares an emergency. There are no amendments before you.
Good morning. We have Sal Esquivel lead us off.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6, Medford. This bill was brought to you by myself and Alan Brickley. We had discussed it with the chair, and we made a committee bill out of it. And what this bill is when I worked for Alan, when I worked at Key Title, I was a Jackson
kind of a
Joseph.
Worker? Oh, excuse me. Sorry to be out of order. I just needed to know.
I was the vice president of Jackson Josephine counties and ran both counties. And we had an inherent problem with people, certain banks, that would you would get ready to close a transaction. Remember, this is your house. So then when they asked for a payoff, we would get a payoff. And then we would disperse the money out, just like we're supposed to. Well, we would reserve maybe $50 for something that may come up, but that's all. Well, when we would go and we'd disperse out, all the monies had been dispersed out, the people took possession of the house, the seller's gone off into the sunset, wherever they go. Then, when we would ask for a release of the debt, the lender would refuse to sign off on it because they said they found more charges. So I don't know how valid that is, but I do know that it's one of two things. It's either incompetence on the part of the lender or they were just being a stickler, one of the two. But it happened pretty regularly with one particular company that I can remember. And so consequently, what we need to have is when we have a payoff, it needs to be cast in stone, and they have to live with it, what they send us, because they are the ones that send the payoff. The title company does not. I'll turn this over to Alan.
Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Kennemer, Vice Chair Barton, members of the committee. My name is Tess Milio with CFM Strategic Communications on behalf of the Oregon Land Title Association. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today regarding House Bill 3244. So first, we just want to thank Chair Holvey and Representative Esquivel for helping us with this bill. Rep. Esquivel and the Oregon Land Title Association, with the assistance of the Oregon Bakers Association, put together House Bill 3244 before you today. So this bill addresses an issue in some real estate transactions that title companies see occur enough to believe a fix is warranted. House Bill 3244 is centered around payoff statements. It takes new property buyers and title companies out of the financial transaction when a lender believes the borrower owes them more money than was originally listed on the payoff statement and paid out to them with the help of the escrow company at closing. House Bill 3244 permits lenders and borrowers to address their contractual agreement independently of the parties involved in the new real estate purchase. So the bill has multiple pieces that I will go through briefly for the committee. The bill adds an assignee or a successor in interest to the definitions of borrower and lender. It also provides a definition for a payoff statement, explaining what that is. The bill changes the language from the word debt to obligation when talking about the balance of a loan due to the lender from the borrower. The bill adds language to clarify the reliance on the most current payoff statement. The bill also provides a path for lenders to collect any additional amount they believe they are owed from the borrower that was not listed on the payoff statement. And the bill establishes how the borrower must satisfy the obligation in the payoff statement. So we have requested a few changes to the bill to have a dash one amendment, and it makes small changes to the language to clarify the intent of the bill and take out construction loans. And this amendment language is to satisfy the concerns of the Oregon Bankers Association and the Northwest Credit Union Association. And we'd like to thank those stakeholders for working with us. And thank you to the committee for your consideration of House Bill 3244. I'm available for any questions, but I'd like to turn it over to Alan Brickley, who is a title professional.
Thank you very much. Excuse me. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Alan Brickley. I am employed by First American Title Company, offices at 121 Southwest Morrison Street in Portland, Oregon. I'm here appearing on behalf of the Oregon Land Title Association, and I would like to also thank Representative Esquivel, Representative Holvey, the Oregon Bankers Association, and others who have assisted in the creation of this bill and to bring it before you. My purpose here, I think Representative Esquivel has identified the problem quite well, and that is we receive payoff statements as part of a real estate closing transaction. That is the borrower seller's typically payoff statement. We pay it, and then the bank comes back later and says, gee, we did an audit or whatever, and now we need X dollars more. It happens with frequency, and the amounts range from several hundred dollars, few dollars. Probably the largest single one that I've personally familiar with was $12,000. And that, by the way, was following a conversation between the borrower, our escrow agent, and the lender. Who's, you know, our borrower said, gee, I don't think that's enough money, and called and confirmed that, and still got a bill later for $12,000. The most egregious one, though, I do have to mention, and that is one in which we did a short sale, which means the borrowers negotiated with the lender for a payoff of a less than the amount owed. That money was dispersed. Approximately 4 months later, the lender rejected the wire. I don't know how you do that 4 months later, but they did, and immediately commenced foreclosure proceedings. I would tell you that matter is still pending. I don't know what the ultimate outcome is going to be. I still, to this day, have no idea why the lender rejected the wire. We have received no notification. I would emphasize that this problem does not exist with local law firms or with local lenders. We simply don't have that problem. I'm only aware of one issue with a local representative, even of a national bank. These all come out of larger institutions out of state. So, but as I say, it happens with enough frequency and with large enough amounts that it's become quite a problem. And with that, I'm available to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to add that it seemed like inevitably that the lender, the originating lender, had sold that off into a secondary market, and that's who we were dealing with, was a secondary lender that's behind the, you know, kind of behind the curtain type situation.
Questions? Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, questions. First of all, let me admit that I don't really understand your industry that well. This is the first part of this, i.e., that that a borrower and title company and party should have an ability to rely on a payoff statement. I think it's very intuitive. It makes a lot of sense. The second part of this, in terms of potential recovery on the borrower, is what I have questions about. And would this, I gather that sometimes a title company chooses to pay off the the difference, basically just a clear title, but is not necessarily obligated to. Is that correct? And my question is this in effect shift that onus from the title company to the borrower?
Well, let me answer the first question first, yes. And that is, are we obligated to? And the short answer to that is yes. As part of the closing, we are obligated to provide a title to the new purchaser in a certain form, and that includes a release of all prior liens. And that's the hammer that the lender has is, well, if you don't pay me, I'm just going to go ahead and foreclose my lien against the new buyer. So in that context, we do have the obligation to clear it for the benefit of that new purchaser. So there is no shifting of burden in that context. The whether or not the borrower remains contractually obligated to the lender to pay that difference is a separate matter. That's a matter of contract as opposed to the closing itself.
May I follow up, Mr.
Yeah,
Chair?
Follow up.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I'm confused.
I think the confusion may be the fact that we're using the word borrower. Actually, it's the seller of the property that
right.
has the mortgage.
Right.
That's the one we're calling the borrower.
So. Thank you. So I got that part. But to the extent that the title company is right now contractually obligated, I suppose, to cover this delta, if this bill were passed according to Section 4 or Paragraph 4 on page 2, this bill would provide it would relieve the title company of that obligation and shift it to the borrower.
No, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, no, that's not correct.
Oh, thank you.
What it does is it basically says that if the disbursement is made in accordance with the payoff statement, the lender can no longer assert a lien on the property, and therefore
it's unsecured.
The debt would then become unsecured, and it's a matter then of contract between the two parties. So that in essence, our industry is not going to be required to pay these amounts, and the buyer, the new person, mm-hmm. Will be free of that lien.
May I follow up?
Follow up.
But the seller, while it might not be a lien, i.e. it would be unsecured, but the debt would shift to the seller, albeit in an unsecured fashion. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I guess I would take issue with the word shift.
Okay.
It doesn't shift. If it is collected from the seller, it is because the seller owes the money in the original instance because they executed the promissory note or whatever other documents. So it doesn't shift the burden. It just simply says this bill does not address the question of the relationship between the seller, borrower in that context, and the lender.
Just to follow up on Representative Barton's question, so this debt that appears after the payoff statement, is it possible that debt's coming from, say, a service company that's servicing the loan for the seller, and they decide after the payoff that they have some more fees or charges that weren't in the agreement, and then they try to put that on this situation? And then, and it doesn't get into the payoff on the property, but that's where it originated from, servicing the loan on that property. And so you're saying, well, you can't do that and encumber this piece of property, but you can go after the seller to collect it in any way you feel you want in an unsecured fashion. I mean, is that possible?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the source of these additional funds or additional fees that are being charged will vary across the board. There's all kinds of reasons. My general experience with it is largely based on an audit done by the lender who said, oh, gee, we forgot to add the attorney's fees because we started a foreclosure, or we forgot to, add 2 or 3 days of interest that was necessary. So I'm not aware of anything coming specifically from the servicing companies. I think it's largely based on those kinds of audits and the failure to include in their payoff statement all of the necessary charges.
But it is, in that scenario, it is as a result of the of the mortgage that the seller has, I'm guessing, and there were fees associated with that mortgage securing that property that's being sold.
Mr. Chairman, yes, that is correct. It's associated with
it. So you're essentially saying we will give that lender, in this case, a second bite of the apple to get their payoff statement right. Though they're not going to encumber the property, they can go after the original seller.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think what we're saying is we're just simply not, this bill does not address the question of the relationship between the borrower and the seller.
It just takes the property out of the equation.
Takes the property out of the equation. As I say, it does not address that relationship.
And Mr. Chair, you can imagine buying a house and then all of a sudden get foreclosed upon for something that the seller had done, and the seller has moved away.
Yeah, that's not right. I totally agree. I mean, that's definitely a problem that I think this bill does solve and needs to be solved. Just trying to figure out, you know, the other relationship with the seller and whether that's really an equitable scenario. And Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, so I think I have this. Person who buys a house, they have it clean, the title's clean, they're safe. The person who incurred the debt, that it is their debt, it stays with them, but the lien is taken off of the house where the lien was before. So now the bank or whatever financial institution or whoever had the lien on the house has to basically just deal with the seller at that point to recoup their money if they want to, or they write it off as a loss at that point, and it keeps the title company from being hit with this hidden lien that was out there that nobody knew about.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Widener, that is correct. So I think that's a fair summation.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much. As we continue to wrap our brains around this, I think it's relatively straightforward. A little glitch still left in my mind we'll have to think about and talk about. But thanks a lot. I think this is an important issue. Glad that Representative Esquivel brought it to my attention, and Mr. Brickley for trying to make the system work better.
Thank you very much.
We have anybody else that wanted to testify on this particular bill? Evidently not. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3244. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 3419.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure prohibits financial institutions from using a broker price opinion to value real property or interest in real property for the purpose of making mortgage loans in connection with a foreclosure or other circumstances where an appraisal is required. It classifies the use of a broker price opinion as an unlawful trade practice, declares an emergency effective on passage, and there are no amendments before you this morning.
Thank you. Lana Butterfield, Owen Bartels, and Brian Brooks, please.
We're going to phone in the person Lana wanted.
Okay, I guess we have to make a phone call real quick. Does anybody want to order anything out?
I know a good donut shop.
Do you want this? Just pause.
This is an espresso delivered.
Good morning, Scotty Viadio.
Good morning. This is Paul Holvey. I'm a state representative, chair of the Oregon House Committee on Business and Labor. And,
good morning, Mr. Chairman.
We're calling you up. We are just opened a hearing on House Bill 3419, which has to do with the use of broker price opinions in valuation of property in certain circumstances. And so we're just getting ready. We'll lead off with some of the people here ready to testify, and then we'll bring you into that conversation.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We did open the public hearing, so if you'd introduce yourself for the record before you provide your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lana Butterfield. I'm here this morning on behalf of the Greater Oregon Chapter of the Appraisal Institute, or GOCAI for short. GOCAI did not ask for this bill. However, we're happy to come here and support it. With me is Owen Bartels, who is the legislative chair here in Oregon and also the treasurer, and he will be followed by Brian Brooks, who is the president of the chapter. I've given you a copy of Beth Aquilizan's testimony because I think it's important for you to see the difference between the education and training requirements of an appraiser versus a realtor. let's see, following us will be Scott on the phone, and he's going to talk to you about specific situations involving foreclosures and short sales. We are proposing some amendments, and he will also talk to you about the amendments.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Owen Bartels. I'm a real estate appraiser. I own a commercial real estate appraisal and consulting firm in Portland, Integra Realty Resources. And as Lana mentioned, I am a member of the Greater Oregon Chapter of the Appraisal Institute. And I'm here today, this morning, to talk to you a little bit about real estate appraisal and broker price opinions. And I want to emphasize that the real estate appraisal industry is one that's focused on consumer protection. We are brought into this process as an impartial actor to help to identify the value of collateral that's being used amongst federally regulated banking institutions, and really see ourselves as a member of the protection of the public, where the FDIC insurance funding is at risk. There is substantial training, as Lana indicated, in being a real estate appraiser. We're licensed by the state. That licensure for commercial appraisers includes 3,000 hours of qualified experience, 300 hours of classroom education, a minimum training period of 30 months, a comprehensive examination, and at least a four-year degree. Further, we are the only, in most cases, the only actors that don't have an interest in the outcome of the transaction. That does protect our impartiality. Broker price opinions, on the other hand, are being done by brokers who don't have specific valuation training, and they're not precluded necessarily from having a vested interest in the outcome of a transaction. Further, there is a standard, the Uniform Standards of Professional Appraisal Practice, to which all real estate appraisal work is done. The uniform standards do not come into play in broker price opinions, and that standard, that uniform standard, really does help to protect the viability of our appraisal product. And for those reasons, I'm happy to be here to talk to you and answer any more questions about appraisal and broker price opinions today.
Mr. Chair and committee members, excuse me, I'm Brian Brooks. I'm the owner of Brooks Appraisal Services in Tualatin, and I'm the president of the Greater Oregon Chapter of the Appraisal Institute. I am in support of this bill, and I'd like to reiterate that two things, that the realtors have an inherent interest in the price and value of real estate, and appraisers don't. Appraisers objective, according to our uniform standards, which are something we partake in the concept of in every appraisal we do, and it's part of our everyday work and frequent conversations we have with other appraisers, is the purpose of USPAP. This is from the preamble of USPAP, Uniform Standards of Professional Appraisal Practice, is the quote, "The purpose of USPAP is to promote and maintain a high level of public trust in appraisal practice by establishing requirements for appraisers. It is essential that appraisers develop and communicate their analysis, opinions, and conclusions to intended users of the service in a manner that is meaningful and not misleading." That's the entire preamble, and that is the purpose of the standards that are promulgated by the Appraisal Foundation in Washington, D.C. And then, you know, the National Association of Realtors have a preamble which it goes on, in the first couple sentences, it talks about that the interest of the nation. Thank you very much.
Chair is a nice guy. Person.
You are a nice guy.
You never do that for me.
Appreciate that. Thank you very much. And the National Association, on the other hand, is their interest is like the widest distribution of land ownership. So when it comes to terms of valuation of real estate, appraisers and realtors have a completely different interest in the valuation. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Representative Kinnemer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the issues in this transfer of property or sales of property is timeliness. And what kind of timelines are typical for getting an appraiser out to and get their report submitted so things can proceed?
For residential Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Kinnemer, the timeline varies according to how busy appraisers are. Currently, right now, it can be a couple weeks because it's a very busy time right now for residential appraisers. But on average, I think from the day it's ordered, say like on a Monday, submitting it the following Monday would be a normal timeline.
And the outside number?
An outside number. For right now, it might be so. It might be 2 weeks. It would be the two Mondays. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kinnemer, if I might chime in also, it does take us some time to complete this process, and the reason that it takes us some time is because we have a very specific set of standards that we follow to ensure the credibility of our reports. And I understand that timeliness is, of course, of the essence in these real estate transactions, and we do encourage all of our practitioners and all of our staff to complete these things in the most timely manner possible. But in order to generate a credible, thorough, well-researched report does take some time. And so I don't believe that the week or two that's typically involved in this process is overburdensome.
Can you tell me what is the potential difference to the consumer in some circumstances where you would use a broker price opinion in a short sale as opposed to an appraisal in a short sale or in a foreclosure? And what is the risk to the consumer for having, you know, do they end up with a different economic outcome in those processes? Could they, if the broker price opinion was, you know, different than the appraisal?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the question, and I would love to refer you to Scott DiBiasio.
I forgot he's on the phone
to answer that for you,
because I think that was kind of the element in this proposal that was sort of getting off, and because I imagine there are a lot of places where broker price opinions are appropriate and are used in the industry. It's not that, it's just in some circumstances I would imagine that the actual outcome of that valuation has an economic impact to the consumer, and so that was, I think, the sort of this bill's been around the legislature for a few years, so. I'll go ahead and open this up to Scott
DiBiasio.
I hope.
Yes, that's correct.
Well, great. If you just introduce or restate your name for the record and provide us some testimony, that would be helpful.
Great. Good morning, Chairman Holvey, Vice Chairs Kinnemer and Barton, and members of the Business and Labor Committee. I'm Scott DiBiasio. I'm with the Appraisal Institute in Washington, D.C. I'm here today to support and corroborate the testimony of the folks that you've just heard from. I appreciate the opportunity and the accommodation to allow me to testify by telephone. I'll first address the two limitations on the use of BPOs that are included in the bill, mortgage loan originations and foreclosures. I'd like to also address an additional area where we think the use of BPOs by financial institutions should be limited, and that's in short sales. And lastly, I will address a package of clarifying amendments that we've drafted that we would like for the committee to consider. Our position has long been that financial institutions should be precluded from using DPOs for residential and commercial mortgage loan origination in foreclosure situations and for purposes of short sales. As the other testifiers have said, this is primarily due to the potential for a broker or salesperson to be biased in favor of their client, which in these cases is the financial institution, when performing DPO services. Of course, state licensed and certified appraisers are required to be independent, impartial, and objective, and to not have any bias towards any one party in the transaction. These same protections do not exist for consumers and for financial institutions when brokers and salespeople are providing real estate valuation services in the form of BPOs. In fact, a broker or salesperson is specifically required to be an advocate for their client. And generally that works well in the sales context, but when a broker or salesperson's client is a financial institution, their advocacy role can result in some outcomes that potentially harm both consumers and financial institutions. For instance, in mortgage loan origination transactions, there's really nothing to prevent a financial institution from attempting to inappropriately influence a broker or salesperson to report a predetermined result. What happens in those cases is that a consumer could end up overpaying for a piece of property and obtaining a mortgage loan on that property for an amount that is in far in excess of the actual market value of the property. That's because the BPO can come in. It's not necessarily done using any standards. It's not done using recognized valuation methods and techniques. And this could result in some harms for both the consumer and for the financial institution. You know, the importance of accurate and reliable real estate valuations prepared by individuals who are competent and qualified to apply appropriate methodologies and techniques should not be underestimated. Unfortunately, BPOs do not fulfill this need on the part of financial institutions. On the same note, as it relates to pre-foreclosure due diligence, lenders have a fiduciary responsibility to obtain the highest value possible on the property, to retain whatever equity is left in the property, and to reduce whatever amount is owed by the consumer to the lender. In addition, financial institutions have a responsibility to minimize the financial impact of a foreclosure on their institution. Unfortunately, in an effort to get rid of to rid their balance sheets of distressed assets, a lot of financial institutions will base their foreclosure sale prices far below market value. And these values are set based upon inaccurate and generally unreliable broker price opinions. We don't believe that it's sufficient, that BPOs are sufficient for financial institutions to accurately and reliably determine the condition of properties, the market appeal, and the marketing timeframes, and other valuation issues. Of course, this is particularly true in commercial properties, where there may be environmental and other issues associated with the property that may not be evident simply from a drive-by inspection and a review of publicly available data. Of course, these are all very, very important things for a financial institution to consider. One other thing is that a BPO could result in a financial institution making a decision to foreclose when the more prudent and financially advisable course of action might be a loan modification, a workout, or some other type of restructuring. There could also be income tax applications for the former owner of a foreclosed property that could result in them underpaying or overpaying income taxes based upon the sales price. Lastly, as it relates to short sales, I'm sure you've all read in the papers with BPOs there exists the possibility for what's called short sale fraud, and that's flopping, where basically the broker or the salesperson will have a third party straw buyer. They will intentionally report an undervaluation for the property based upon a BPO, The financial institution will then accept that BPO and sell that property to the straw buyer based upon the lowball BPO. And then the straw buyer will turn right around and sell it at the true market value and pocket the difference. And of course, the broker or the salesperson in that transaction makes commissions on both sides of that. Estimates are that short sale fraud occurs in more than 1% of short sale transactions and results in $50 million in lost revenue to financial institutions annually. There's many former real estate brokers and salespeople who are now in prison because of short sale fraud and providing fraudulent broker price opinions in relation to short sales. I won't go into it, but if you take a look on the internet, there's all kinds of books and websites out there. One of them is called the BPO Cash Generator blog, and it basically tells and purports to train brokers how to engage in this practice of lowballing BPOs. So in summary, we do not believe that the risks associated with financial institutions using BPOs for mortgage loan origination, foreclosures, and short sales are worth the difference in price between a BPO and an accurate and reliable appraisal performed by a competent and qualified real estate appraiser that is acting independently from any party with no financial or other interest in the transaction. We strongly support the intent of HB 3419. We do have a package of amendments we would like for the committee to consider when it's appropriate. They don't really change the intent of the legislation at all. They basically just move the existing provisions of the bill into an existing section of the statutes, the Appraiser Licensing and Certification Law, which is ORS 674.100. That section of the law already addresses the use of an analysis, evaluation, opinion, conclusion, notation, or compilation of data by a financial institution. Basically, what our amendments say is basically that financial institutions can continue to use evaluations, BPOs, comparative market analyses, or letter opinions for any purpose except for mortgage loan origination, foreclosures, and short sales. The amendments do not change the intent or the impact of the bill, and we would appreciate the committee's favorable consideration of these amendments. Again, I appreciate the opportunity to offer our viewpoints on HB 3419, and I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you. Does anybody have a question? I really appreciate your testimony. It was pretty thorough. I hope we have that in writing.
Mr. Chairman, I will submit it in writing to the committee.
Thank you. You could just email it to us, and I'm sure if you don't have our email address, we'll get it to you.
Absolutely. If not, I will get it to Lana, and I will. I'm sure she will get it into the appropriate hands.
Thank you. You can stay on the line if you would like. There might be another question that comes up as we move along.
I will do that.
Mr. Chair, the amendments have been submitted by your office to Legislative Council, but they're not back yet. However, the draft of what we sent to you is under my name online.
Okay.
Which means it's an exhibit online for on
Olds. On Olds. Okay, so you can kind of look at and see what the amendments are heading towards anyway. Appreciate that. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Up next, Sean Jillians.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, members of the committee, for the record, Sean Jillians today representing unregulated shysters, apparently. the Oregon Association of
Regulators. Regulated.
Oh, gosh.
And Yes, in fact, real estate licensees are regulated.
I guess you're impugning yourself.
I know, exactly.
But you are impugning other realtors, and I don't think that was the intent of anybody that's testified on this issue.
I would tend to differ a little with the last gentleman in sort of the claims there. But real estate licensees are regulated under ORS 696. We do have the real estate agency that oversees their duties, and 696-800 has a number of duties that real estate licensees owe to their clients. The other thing that I would point out, Mr. Chair, and when we met the other day to talk about this, I pointed you to Oregon Administrative Rule 863.015.0190, and I'll make sure that the committee has a copy of that. But that actually is a regulation around broker price opinions by the Oregon Real Estate Agency and what they can and cannot be used for. Broker price opinions, in the more general sense, at the national level, are sort of what you've heard. They're more restricted here in Oregon via our administrative rule. A broker price opinion, in the general concept, is typically only between a real estate licensee and their particular client who's putting the property on the market. And there are a number of disclaimers that have to be in there, including the fact that this does not meet the USPAP standards. It also says, you know, if an appraisal is needed, they recommend that you go with that. Now, we do have a couple of other sort of avenues that are used, and that's a lending collateral analysis. That's only for the internal purposes of a financial institution. Those are limited to transactions under $250,000. Other than that, they cannot be utilized. Again, similar disclaimers about the need for appraisals and to go with a certified appraiser if that need be. The final one is a default collateral analysis, and those are only for loans in default. So we do actually have more restrictions in Oregon currently under our administrative rules. And we think that those have served the public well. As I mentioned, Mr. Chair, we do have significant concerns with the bill as drafted. We think a lot of what the proponents have talked about is actually covered under administrative rule, not necessarily in revised statute. That being said, OLIS was crashed this morning, so I haven't had an opportunity to view the amendments. I'm happy to look those over and follow back up with you, Mr. Chair. With that, happy to answer any questions.
Questions, Representative Esquivel.
Yes. Unless something's changed, a lender can't use a BPO, a broker's opinion, for a loan anyway. It has to be done by an appraiser. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, I believe under
FHA and
a lending collateral analysis, in theory, a financial institution could utilize that in theory. Now, whether or not that would survive underwriting and any sort of securitization of Freddie, Fannie, everything else, the chances are zero of that. As we know, the vast majority of loans are purchased on the secondary market after that. I suppose if an institution, and probably representatives of the institutions would be better suited to answer this question, but I suppose if they were actually holding the note themselves, which is fairly rare, they might in theory be able to utilize this if it was a loan under $250,000.
Mr. Chair, follow-up?
Follow-up.
I've been a broker for 20-some years, and I've never seen that happen. Okay. Could, may happen, possible. I mean, I like the selection of words. Do appraisers lose their license due to incompetence and shady dealings at time to time? Answer is yes. It's not just realtors, it's appraisers as well. Obviously, the system works because they're in jail. Same with the realtors. We mentioned here that the realtors, there's some in jail. And rightfully they should be, because we have a very strict law that we adhere to. I thought that they had to sit down on a foreclosure anyway and mediate with the people to see if they can reconstruct their loan anyway. I thought we passed something on that. So I'm kind of confused on what that has to do with the people getting together. I don't think a foreclosure, because usually a foreclosure, they've been out a year, possibly 2 years, maybe even as long as 3 years without ever paying a payment, and there's no way that they usually can catch up. So anyway, what is your opinion on the mediation part where they get together? Isn't that true that we're supposed to do that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, yes, that is required by statute that we have mediation now, and that has been expanded over the last couple of sessions, obviously as a result of the crash of the real estate market starting in 2007.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not a member of the Shyster community. I have a couple questions here. One is, I bought commercial property, I've bought residential property, different things. And usually when I've sold, I mean, you rely on the realtors to get the comps, and the way things are now with Zillow and so many different things out there, you have a good idea of what your property's worth just by looking online. But when you go to do that loan, so the realtors are doing a great job of pricing the property at the max of what it should do and then negotiating. The banks, don't they require, I mean, every time I've been required to have an appraisal from an appraiser, a third-party appraiser at that point, and kind of use that for negotiation for my price even more at that point, depending upon how the appraisal comes back. It lets me know if I'm going to be able to knock them down more or not. And then you also have the home inspector on top of that. So it's a lot of fees that add up that I see happening over time. And I'm just wondering, I always thought that the appraiser and the inspector should be kind of linked together as one, so you're not getting hit with $1,200 in fees rather than $600. Comment on that, or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, well, there's several questions in there. I think the first part of your answer, a typical transaction, yes, an appraisal is always included in that. The second part of your question, as far as home inspectors and appraisers, not to speak for my colleagues behind me, but I think there's a very different skill set and licensing requirements for that. Home inspectors are actually licensed by the Construction Contractors Board. Appraisers are licensed by their board. Those are very, very different things. A home inspection may play a factor into an appraisal, but they're very distinct functions.
So, Sean, I don't think anybody was arguing that we do have appraisals on loan origination. And do the OARs that you're speaking about, do they address short sales and foreclosures and the use of BPOs? And maybe that's a question. Are broker price opinions used in establishing valuation in the foreclosure process or the short sale process?
Mr. Chair, I think there, again, two questions there. One, it's not the traditional broker price opinion. The definition of the administrative rule is a default collateral analysis on loans that are in default that a financial institution might utilize. Quite honestly, probably the financial institutions are the better folks to answer that question as far as what they utilize those for. A short sale, if a bank comes to a realtor to sell the property, the realtor is going to give them whatever the market value is to sell that. That's very different than an analysis of how much is owed there. That's an internal decision by the bank, and only they know how much is owed on the note.
Does the outcome of that short sale have any impact on the economic outcome of the consumer?
It depends on the situation, Mr. Chair. I think it can. We obviously have been strong proponents of pushing for mortgage debt relief, which is at the federal level, where we say people do not have to recognize the income generated, what we would term phantom income, where they lost money on a home, but it's deemed that since it was forgiven, they had to pay taxes on it. We've been successful thus far in getting that extended on a year-by-year basis at the federal level, but it's been a significant fight every year. This last year it actually expired, and we had to get it done retroactively in February. So those are the situations where a consumer would actually be impacted in a short sale and how much they potentially would have to pay in taxes where they were upside down on the property.
All right. So I appreciate that. Any other questions? Appreciate that. I look forward to seeing the amendments, and I'm sure we'll have some more conversation about the amendments, and hopefully we can sit down and have a little conversation about what may or may not be going forward.
Happy to continue the dialogue, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Up next, I have T.R. Harris. Good morning. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Harris, TR for short. I work for myself, H&S Appraisal, which I own. I'm here not to represent anyone. I'm not a member of any organization. I am independent, and the one reason I'm here is because I've seen both sides of the lending and appraisal issue over my 48 years experience. I started work at Bank of America as an appraiser. I went to U.S. Bank for 7 years. I was senior appraiser there and in charge of statewide training of all of U.S. Bank's appraisers. I left U.S. Bank in 1979, went to what was then called Fred Meyer Savings, subsequently became Willamette Savings. I was senior vice president there, and I went there as manager of the appraisal department. I became a permanent member of Loan Committee, which I co-chaired, and I was in charge of what was called Project Loans. I was a manager of the Project Loan Department. I went to Community First Federal Savings in Vancouver. I went there as manager of the Loan Service Department, which at that time included the Appraisal Department. I again was co-chair of the loan committee, and became actually for a short period of time the manager of the loan department. Over the years, I've seen both sides of the equation, and I'm here because I have gray hair, and I've been around for a long time, and I go back to the days before appraisers were actually regulated and before we had the kinds of regulations and laws that appraisers have to conform with today. I see the BPO as, I mean, I really have no objection to BPOs when they're properly used. But I'm concerned that there may be a tendency to creep to areas where they're infringing on what federal and state regulations require of appraisers. And that is the kinds of works that maintain integrity between the public and the valuation services that appraisers provide. Now, I personally have no dog in this fight because my specialties don't include residential appraisals. But I am here because of my past, because I greatly support the regulations that have occurred over time since beginning in 1980, following the crash that occurred then. And at that time, it was largely due to faulty appraisals under the unregulated conditions that existed before the R41B and subsequently USPAP and down the line. That really covers pretty much what I have to say. I I certainly urge you to support HB 3419. I think it's needed not because it's out of control today at all, but the tendency there to use relationship possibilities between individual lenders and individual realtors exists, and it's a slippery slope if it gets out of control. I think HB 3419 covers those issues and protects the consumer throughout the state of Oregon. Thank you for your consideration. I'm happy to answer any questions.
So just questions? So just real briefly, do you think that there is issues with the use of BPOs in the foreclosure process and in the short sale process where appraisals should be used instead?
Representative Holvey, I have witnessed that, yes, in my particular area. Again, I don't get involved in many residential appraisals, but I did happen to work with Department of Justice on an issue in Bend, and I used some of the short sales that had been based on broker price opinions. I used an adjustment to make them comparable to current market value, and that's the only reason I could use the short sales as an indication of market value. And the short sales typically that particularly in the one case, I think it was a 10% adjustment to get it back to market.
Thank you. Representative Widener, a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you think, looking at this and being involved with things, you think technology is changing a lot of this, especially when you get into residential appraisals? If you heard me mention Zillow earlier, there's lots of different companies out there where, I mean, you can jump online and get a really good idea of what the valuation of your property is nowadays. 15 years ago, you didn't have this access. And to get a legitimate appraisal 15 years ago, it made sense, where now you can get a rough idea of a real good idea of what your property's worth just by jumping online and seeing what they've sold for.
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, yeah, that's true. There has been a great change in technology. The issue here, though, is, and I'm not accusing realtors of being the bad guys at all.
No. I was just saying the need for actually even appraisers. This is basically coming in. I mean, commercial makes a lot of sense to me. Residential, I mean, you can get a real good idea of where things are at with a residential property quickly, where commercial you can't.
Yeah, and that's true. It's the technology is widespread, and a lot of the MLS information is available. It isn't the fact that you can get an idea of what the property is worth. It is the considerations of not only size and construction type comparability. This actually includes condition of the home. It includes, a thorough inspection of the home by an appraiser. It includes verifying size and a lot of things that don't go into online information. And I guess the issue here is one of of economics. An appraisal costs more money because appraisers have to do much more to satisfy their regulatory requirements.
Thank you. Representative Doherty, your question?
Sir, I think you answered my question because with the Zillows and looking online, it does not take into effect whether you've gone through and remodeled a kitchen with top-of-the-line appliances, whether your hardwood has come in, whether you've redone bathrooms and upgraded it and all that kind of thing. So those are not taken into consideration as opposed to an actual person coming in and seeing the value of that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Doherty, exactly right. Yeah, it's there's much more that goes into an appraisal, and I'm not saying that the BPO might come in at the same value, but many times there's a relationship that develops in an unregulated situation, and salespeople by nature are tend to be advocates for their client. Appraisers are not allowed to advocate for anyone's interest, and we have to certify to that effect.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much.
Further questions? Representative Esquivel.
But when you say they advocate for the client, that's true, because if you hire me, I advocate for you as the seller. But then usually, let's say Ms. Representative Evans is another realtor, he has the buyer. Now, if there's any question on that, he has his own opinion on what the value of the property is. I have my opinion, and usually they're within 3%. Think about that. The realtors are the ones that set the price, and then the market is the one that actually pays for it. Because I don't care what you appraise something. I don't care what you have an opinion on. It depends upon the individuals that buy it. That's a fact. And I'll tell you why. I had a $450,000 listing back, oh, gee, many Christmas. Must have been 15 years ago. And Roy Wright, a friend of mine, do you know Roy?
No, I don't.
Okay, he's the big kingpin down in Southern Oregon. But Roy did the appraisal on it. I said, Roy, you know, I got a $450,000 listing here. I said, how do you think it'll pan out? And Roy looked at me and he said, you know, if that thing was made of gold, I couldn't make it $450,000. So we ended up selling it for $450,000 because the buyer decided they wanted to go past the appraisal. But that's the way that system works. In Southern Oregon, we're within 3% of the list price and what it sells for. So that's pretty accurate, correct? That's pretty accurate.
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Esquivel, you're right. Appraisers are not at war with realtors. We work together.
Right.
We call you for verification.
You have a personal relationship, but it's not a personal relationship like let's do this or let's do that. It's I respect your profession. You respect mine.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We do different things, really.
That's right.
Any more questions, comments for this gentleman? Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Mr. DiBiasio, are you still on the phone? Okay. He's off the phone. So with that, anyone else like to be heard on House Bill 3419? We're going to move on then. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3419. And we are going to, Chair Holvey said, move ahead. And we are going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3185. Again, can you tell us about this bill, please?
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure exempts corporations, governments, government subdivisions or agencies, trusts, estates, partnerships, cooperatives, and associations from mortgage loan originator license requirements if they, as acting as a seller, they offer or negotiate no more than 3 residential mortgage loans in a 12-month period and becomes operative 91 days after the effective date, declares an emergency effective on passage, and no amendments today.
All right. In a surprise development, our first panel appears to be Representative Kenemer and Mr. Jillians. Go ahead. These are the only two signed up for this bill.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bill Kenmer, State Representative, District 39. I appreciate the opportunity to provide testimony and appreciate the hearing. I introduced this bill on behalf of the Board of Realtors because there have been some changes in federal regulations, and obviously there are some statutes that need to be updated. In the process of trying to do that, it's been difficult to get those amendments formulated correctly, and we are still in the process of updating those amendments. So today we're going to talk in more generalities about where we're going. But I would say last night I appreciated the outstanding work of our administrator, who at 4:40 let me know that DCBS had entered a letter in OLIS. And I thought I'd mention that today because historically there's been a courtesy of notifying the sponsor when an agency has concerns, and I think perhaps their response might have been different had they indulged in that courtesy, mm-hmm. And perhaps not. But at least I would like to have had that opportunity before a letter is entered into OLIS, and I just wanted to put that on the record.
Thank you, Representative. That's something that we can all relate to. We've all had that experience a time or two, and I think it's as good. Courtesy is there for a reason. It's a good practice. It makes this building work a little easier, and I'm sure.
Thank you,
Mr.
Chair.
I'd like to think that won't happen again.
That's why I thought we ought to mention it.
I'm glad you did. Mr. Jillians, please.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Sean Jillians, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I thought I'd give a little bit of background on the seller financing issue. In 2008, Congress passed and the President signed the SAFE Act, which required the regulation and licensing of loan originators. It was something that our association supported. And then in 2009, the states were given the duty to implement the provisions of the SAFE Act with their own statutes or have the feds come in and run the program for them. We did do that. That was House Bill 2189 in 2009. During that same period as we were doing that, the Dodd-Frank Act passed, which was obviously sweeping regulation at the federal level. In 2010, in this same field about loan origination, who should be licensed, putting more restrictions for good reason, more consumer protection in there. However, seller financing, which is where an individual owns a property and wants to sell it and carry the note on it, it's traditionally been a form of financing that's available during tough credit times, and it's more appealing during tough credit times. Seller financing sort of got swept up in those regulations. And when we passed 2189, we took a very, very narrow view of who should be excluded from loan originator licensing. In fact, attorneys sort of got cut out and couldn't even give advice to their clients on it. Through rulemaking, we sort of clarified that, which was a good thing. But since we originally passed that bill, we've sort of come back and chipped away at the state statute. And in 2013, we looked at what the original sort of language of Dodd-Frank was and allowed for the exclusion that you see right now, which is three properties in a 12-month period just for individuals. We put a cap on it of eight that you could hold at any one time without either using a licensed loan originator or getting the license yourself and bonding and education requirements. It's very sort of a complex process for just the individual mom and pop who wanted to sell one property and carry the note on it. Since we passed that unanimously, you all passed that unanimously in 2013, CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau at the federal level, finally issued their rules for Dodd-Frank, roaring out in a quick four-year time frame. And those went into effect in January of 2014 after the session. And so as Representative Kenmer said, the intent of the bill is to mirror those federal statutes because we've had a number of questions of does the state statute apply, does the federal statute apply. You get three lawyers in a room, you got five opinions. And we seem to think that streamlining it and making it more clear, these are the federal rules. Obviously, the federal rules are always going to apply, and sort of clarifying who's allowed to do it, the circumstances under which they can. The original bill as drafted was pretty simple. I just literally took a chunk of the federal rule and stuck it into the bill. I knew that DCBS had concerns with that. And so in order to try to address those concerns, we did have a Dash 1 amendment created, which literally mirrors the exact language of the federal rule. I understand, I heard from DCBS yesterday afternoon that they still had concerns with that. So happy to work with the sponsor, with the committee members, DCBS, figure out how we can clarify what rules apply, because I really think there's a great deal of confusion out there, and it's sort of a burden on DCBS too, because we get to see all the email traffic that goes to them of, does this apply, does this apply? They've been terrific. Kristen Anderson, who's over there, who's in their regulatory department, answers all these real estate licensee questions. She comes and gives webinars. She speaks at all our seminars. Hopefully we can get to a point where everyone understands the rules and that's not as necessary. But with that, Mr. Vice Chair, happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. In addition to DCBS, I know that Chair Holvey has expressed some questions/concerns about this. I would encourage you guys to communicate with him as well as the agency directly.
Yeah.
Anyone else who's interested in this bill, you should talk with Chair Holvey. With that, does anyone have any questions or comments of this bill or this panel? We've had enough of this one for today. Okay, well, good. Good news is we get to move on to Cemetery Day. So with that, we will close public hearing on House Bill 3185.
Yeah, that's good news.
Should we, that makes sense to have, should we do one at a time?
No, they're quite different.
I know. I don't know anything about this.
Okay, let Cemetery Day begin. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3242. Jan, will you tell us about this bill, please?
Mr. Chair and committee members, this permits the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board to assume the control of insolvent, bankrupt, or disowned cemeteries in order to carry out existing pre-arrangement sales contracts to which the cemetery is a party and to affect the rights of plot owners. And it directs the board to adopt rules, declares an emergency, and there are no amendments today. It's Dan.
So with that, can we have Wally Orderman, I believe it is, would you come up and tell us about this bill? And when he is finished, we're going to have Mr. Cochran and Ms. Fox testify. Good morning.
Good morning.
Please just introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Vice Chair Barton, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Wally Orderman. I'm a funeral director in Albany, and I represent the Oregon Funeral Directors Association. OFDA asked for this legislation and came about because of a very real need to provide the Mortuary and Cemetery Board with the tools and the leverage to assist Oregonians when cemeteries, excuse me, have ceased to operate due to abandonment, bankruptcy, or disciplinary action. At this time, the Mortuary and Cemetery Board is not able to step in under these circumstances and operate a cemetery, nor do we feel they should. As the regulatory authority, they certainly don't have the expertise or the ability to run a cemetery. But we would like to be able to provide the tools, or hope this legislation will provide the tools that allow them to appoint someone when a cemetery sometimes instantly becomes a non-cemetery because of not having a licensee to manage. We believe that they should be able to appoint others who could step in temporarily so that burials can still take place in circumstances where there's been a death. The burial property is already owned by the consumer, and that there's no person or entity with the legal right to get the burial done. As you can imagine, these issues can be very time sensitive, as well as emotionally challenging for grieving families. The temporary permits that the Mortuary and Cemetery Board could issue would be to a qualified person, someone from the industry, which could be another local cemetery, could be a funeral director in the area, or someone that works within the cemetery business. For instance, someone that is a grave digger or a vault company that also offers those types of services. There have been two major situations just within the last year and a half where this issue has come to the forefront. One in my own particular community where, due to disciplinary action, a cemeterian lost his license and the cemetery lost its license and, as I said before, instantly became a non-cemetery. It was unlicensed, and you cannot do a burial in an unlicensed cemetery. This was actually resolved at the 11th hour because someone out of the goodness of their heart who is within the is a funeral licensee stepped forward to take over the temporary interim type manager position so that that cemetery could be relicensed. Mortuary Board was able to fast track the licensing procedure, and this person was installed into that spot. And we literally had told the family of the deceased that their burial was likely on hold, and we didn't know how long that was likely to last. And even started having the conversation, even though they own property in this cemetery, was it possible that they were going to need to go to a different cemetery and purchase another grave so the burial could take place? Again, going back to that time sensitivity. While the bill certainly addressed this issue, as the language, as we started looking at the language of how the bill was crafted, we found, as well as the Mortuary and Cemetery Board found, that this was too broad, and actually gave the Mortuary and Cemetery Board more authority to do more than what was originally intended, and the Mortuary and Cemetery Board agreed. I should mention that Michelle Gaines with the Mortuary and Cemetery Board is seated behind me and is available for comment or questions on some of the background and technical parts of this as well. We do have dash one amendment language that I'm not sure if you have in front of you that we are proposing. Because of the broadness of 3242, what we would like to do is have this bill as being a fix immediately as far as being able to issue temporary permits, but we would like to establish a task force with a lot of the stakeholders, any potential stakeholders that have an interest in this, to make recommendations for a long-term fix. We do feel there's an immediate need, and so we don't want to wait for the possibility of temporary permits to be issued. But the task force would look at this and report back to the legislature no later than March of 2016. Also, within the dash one language, would allow the Mortuary and Cemetery Board to grant a temporary permit for the sole purpose of authorizing an interment in a cemetery that does not have a valid license to operate at that time. These would be on a case-by-case basis and very situational. And this dash one language would allow for that. A permit would only be granted when there is a pre-existing right of interment within the cemetery, the subject cemetery, and there has been a death requiring a burial, which means you could not issue a temporary permit and then have a new grave sale. This would be for people that are deeded property owners within these cemeteries, and there's been a death, and the burial needs to take place. Anyone receiving one of these temporary permits would still be bound by the laws of Oregon and paperwork, disclosures, etc., that the cemeteries need to abide by now. There would not be a fee for this permit, and the permit authority would automatically sunset in January of 2017, the reason being we're hoping the task force in their work would be able to establish a more permanent fix to this. In closing, the Oregon Funeral Directors Association feels that this legislation is necessary for the protection of Oregon citizens. Having worked with grieving people for 30-plus years, I can say with all certainty that this bill certainly can provide a level of protection when people don't need any more angst. And with that, I would entertain any questions you might have.
Representative Wagner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Because my question a little bit would be, and I understand this a little bit because I have to mow the cemetery all the time because my family has a cemetery that's been there since mid-1800s. So 1820, 1850, it's been there forever. And I get the fortunate job of having to take care of it and mow the grass and be a member of the board that I didn't choose to be and get to hear how I get to inherit it all the time. And I don't know if it's something that I want to inherit, but it is part of our family. And I'm just wondering, we work with our local funeral home, and there's lots of times where people pass away and they don't have money for a plot. And I mean, we've donated plots, give plots to people. It's not a lot to get a plot at our cemetery, and I'm just wondering how this, what egregious things have happened. I just can't see it. I mean, or what's going on? What are we trying to fix here, I guess, is where I'm getting at, because you said there, you had an issue down in Albany, and I'd be kind of curious what the issue was, what's going on with it. Because there's a lot of cemeteries like ours that are out there that are owned by independent people. And I'm just wondering what's going to happen to some of them, because some of them are family cemeteries, too, or community cemeteries.
Excuse me. Chair Holvey and Representative Widener, you've spoken actually to a couple of different issues here. One is, and I'm glad you brought up the point, that some of these cemeteries are run by volunteers or run by fraternal organizations, a few some municipalities, but many rural cemeteries, and by rural I mean can be outlying areas of metro areas as well, but some cemeteries, many cemeteries in Oregon, are run by volunteers, and those volunteers are an aging population, and we anticipate that the abandonment issue with cemeteries certainly, as the volunteerism depletes in taking care of those cemeteries, we think this could be an issue. The other thing I want to say to that is that not all cemeteries, if cemeteries don't reach a certain threshold of burials per 2 years, or I can't remember what the figures are, and Michelle Gaines would be able to answer this better, aren't required to be licensed cemeteries in Oregon, probably registered but not licensed, and I would look to her to back me up on that.
Representative Barton, question.
Thank you. A comment, two of them to be precise, both intended to be constructive and to help you get your bill passed. Number one, and forgive me, this is my comments are directed to the bill as written. I have not reviewed the -1 amendment. I suspect that the -1 amendment perhaps was designed with my comments in mind. Very sympathetic to the objective. There are a lot of parallel procedures for with other agencies do that in kind of cases of immediate need. For example, the state bar, they have to go in and get a court order if an attorney has to take over a practice if attorneys no longer functional or incapacitated. There is a procedure in place. We had a controversial bill recently involving Bali cease and desist that's pending and before the floor right now. There's an administrative process. An agency makes a final order that can be appealed through standard administrative process. The actual form, there should be some procedure defined so that there's some kind of check, just so you know. There are a lot of different ways to get about that, but that's something I think would need to be in the bill. You also mentioned, perhaps recognizing that you'd need to do perhaps a task force to further look at that issue, but you needed something in the short term. That's entirely appropriate. From time to time, we do that a couple times a session. Usually in those cases, then we would put a sunset on the bill to basically give you guys time to work something out. But anyway, I think both of those are things that are worth considering if you want to pass this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair
Holvey and Vice Chair Barton. Thank you for that. And certainly the first point that you made, the task force would be, those are the kinds of issues the task force would be looking for. Currently, there is not, that I'm aware of, a mechanism for going to a local court or municipality to ask them to take over a cemetery. And I don't know who would make that request, and that would be something we would want to address in that as well. The dash one language does talk about a sunset of this, so that the task force hopefully would establish a long-term fix to this.
Thank you very much. And if you need a legislator to help you with your task force, I think I know one.
Representative Whitener. It's in the family. It's family business.
I really appreciate your testimony, and you know, I think it is an issue that we should deal with, and so I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, Chair.
I'd like to bring up Ty Cochran and Rachel Fox. Introduce yourself for the record.
Chair Holding, members of the committee, my name is Ty Cochran. I'm with the Cemetery Association of Oregon. I've been a cemeterian for over 30 years, manage a large cemetery here in Salem. During that time, I've actually held regional positions where my travels took me across the United States, where scenarios like Twin Oaks and Sunset Hills have happened, and the company I worked for actually has went through and taken over the record keeping of those mostly smaller cemeteries, and continued with the operations. Obviously, the laws in other states are quite different than Oregon when it comes to this, but I have supplied you with some written testimony, but mainly I just want to express our interest in working with the task force that's been mentioned. I am a firm believer that something does need to be done. I do know about the cases at Twin Oaks and Sunset Hills, and as far as the Cemetery Association of Oregon, I think we have a little more expertise than maybe the OFDA and the State Board does when it comes to operating these cemeteries. But mainly I'm here just to answer any questions if you have any, and I'll turn it over to Rachel Fox, who is the president of the Cemetery Association. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Holvey and Vice Chairs Barton and Kinnemer and the committee. As Ty introduced me, I'm Rachel Fox. I'm the president of the Cemetery Association of Oregon. And since 2008, I've been involved with municipal and corporate cemetery operations. In both roles, I was voted on the board of the association by its members. Both in a municipal role, or as in a municipal role, I served as the manager of Oregon's largest public agency provider of municipal interments. And in a corporate role, I work for the largest corporation in North America, who provides funeral, crematory, and cemetery services. From 2008 to 2013, the municipal cemeteries I operated for Metro Regional Government were either abandoned or dissolved, and authority to oversee the operations and the records were given to Multnomah County through several mid-20th century acts. Many of the client families served had pre-arrangements with the original operator, of which Multnomah County and eventually Metro were tasked with fulfilling those pre-arrangements. I just want to bring it to everybody's attention that this issue is not unique to any state in the union or any country with similar common laws, but nonetheless, it's really upsetting to client families. Not only do these issues exist, there are preceding laws and professional organizations such as ours who have the knowledge to mitigate these problems. While there have been recent issues with the two rather large cemeteries in the state of Oregon, our state also faces these issues with smaller, not-for-profit, volunteer-run organizations. So we're talking about the final resting place of someone's loved one. A regulatory agency is not equipped to meet with families, address their concerns, make arrangements for final disposition, schedule the date and time of a graveside service, or perform the sexton duties on the day of the graveside. Additionally, state regulators are not equipped to offer choices to families for burial vaults or headstones. However, as the Oregon Mortuary Cemetery Board and the Oregon Funeral Directors Association, along with the Cemetery Association of Oregon, we all believe that these issues should be managed locally not by a state regulatory agency, but by a municipality who has access to public opinion, resolve disputes, and coupled with issuing a temporary license to a cemetery operator who is knowledgeable in interment right verification, and that means finding the right burial spot for the deceased, who have knowledge in cemetery records and interment practices, and fulfilling pre-arrangements, it would allow for a more sensitive and proactive role. The Cemetery Association of Oregon believes that the proposal should be set in statute and not by administrative rule, as the bill states. The association cannot support the bill as originally written, as it falls short as best serving the cemetery consumer. A task force, as proposed by the amendment, is the best course of measure to resolve future issues. The Cemetery Association of Oregon is ready to be a part of that task force.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Questions? Not seeing any. I do appreciate your participation. I think we'll need it. So,
Chair Holby, if I can mention, members of the committee, I don't know if I mentioned this, but we saw a draft of the amendments. We haven't seen any form, anything that's been proposed to us as a final. We were okay with the draft, so we're okay if that was what was actually given to you.
Yeah. Well, frankly, I haven't seen it either.
Okay.
So, you know.
Well, maybe I won't.
It's
maybe
an ongoing,
with it then.
It's a dynamic process.
Okay.
And we'll keep working on it. So I appreciate your testimony this morning.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Let's see where we are now. So I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3242 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3243.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure directs the Mortuary and Cemetery Board to reimburse a funeral establishment for the costs related to the disposal of the unclaimed body of an indigent person. It moves the responsibility for collecting the fee on the death certificate from OHA to the Mortuary Board, allows the board to set by rule the fee for the filing death certificate, and it directs at least $7 of each collected fee to be used to reimburse the funeral establishments for disposing the unclaimed bodies of indigent people, modifies the definition of an indigent person, declares an emergency. There's no amendment, and Legislative Fiscal Office has requested, if the committee moves this bill, that it does go to Ways and Means.
Thank you. Wally Ordeman and Randy Tajdern?
Jaden.
Jeez. Whoa.
You were
sorry.
Close, Mr. Chair.
I wasn't even close.
Nice handwriting.
That's a J?
Or spelling of a name, yeah.
It's a silent T.
Silent T. Threw me. So, good morning. If you'd introduce yourself for the record again.
Good morning again. Thank you, Chair Holby. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Wally Ordeman, representing the Oregon Funeral Directors Association. A day or so ago, we provided a summary and some background on the goals of this legislation, and so I won't belabor that. The Oregon Funeral Directors Association has had concerns for many years about the consistency of the Indigent Disposition Fund. And fragmented management of the fund, which was created to ease the financial burden of caring for those who pass away in the state and have nobody to take responsibility and pay for disposition. Through Representative Hoyle, House Bill 3243 was crafted so that we can narrow the definition of indigent, more clearly define it, and expand the criteria in which funeral providers must follow in applying to this fund, which is a reimbursement fund. These concepts for the bill have come from many sources within the industry, not the least of which was a very well-attended strategic planning session last summer hosted by the Mortuary and Cemetery Board, in which there was excellent data collected and some very diverse opinions were heard. As we advocate for the move of this program to the oversight of the Mortuary and Cemetery Board. They anticipate that they can manage this program with no current increase to the death certificate filing fee, which is what pays in every death in Oregon. There's a death certificate filing fee, and a portion of that fee goes into the Indigent Disposition Fund. We encourage the shift of this program to the oversight of the Mortuary and Cemetery Board without reservation. Since the bill was introduced, there's been some additional good discussion that's brought about the need for a Dash 1 amendment. Some of those improvements, because I don't believe you have the language of that amendment in front of you, I'd just like to highlight a few things. One would be adding a third level of possible responsible parties. When death occurs, there are different classifications of who can authorize disposition. Adding a third level of possible responsible parties who have refused to participate and pay, such as a neighbor, a friend, church, which would, again, narrows the definition of who can apply to this fund. Adding two steps to the funeral service practitioner, that the funeral service practitioner must follow by requiring contact with the Department of State Lands to use their resources to locate possible controlling parties. And also the VA to inquire if the deceased was a veteran, as well as any veterans benefits that might be coming, which expands the criteria. Removing the OHSU demonstrator of anatomy as the responsible position for maintaining the list of potential body donation recipients and puts the Mortuary and Cemetery Board in that role. The language also, or the Dash 1 amendment, would also direct that teaching embalming labs, most notably in Oregon, Mount Hood Community College, that program return indigent cases to the originating funeral homes, and those funeral homes then would be able to apply to the fund. Also, the Dash 1 would add back in. The original language had taken out the having the $20 death certificate filing fee in statute. The Dash 1 amendment would put that back in so that it's not vulnerable through rulemaking. The Funeral Directors Association is not aware of any opposition to this bill. Has worked very hard over a long period of time with all known stakeholders to try and make this good law. Funeral directors throughout the state understand that indigent cases need to be cared for. By nature, we're a compassionate industry, and understand dignity and respect. Our goal for the Indigent Disposition Fund is consistency, and will never, certainly with the small amount that is paid to funeral homes, this will never be about, this fund will never be about profit for the funeral home, but just recouping some expenses. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions. I will say before any questions that I'm joined by Randy Jaden, who has extensive knowledge about this and has had a vested interest in, because of his positioning in the industry, in this fund, has quite a bit of experience, and so I had asked him to join us today. But I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Jaden, would you like to introduce yourself and give us whatever comments you'd like?
Yeah, absolutely, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Randy Jaden, and that is with a silent, confusing T in front of it.
definitely confused me.
Yeah, it is confusing. I own and operate Cascade Funeral Directors Incorporated. We are a family-owned Oregon business. We operate funeral establishments throughout the Portland metropolitan area and the North Willamette Valley. We're one of the largest death care providers in the state of Oregon. For many years, I have advocated for change in the management of the and oversight of the Indigent Disposition Fund. I've asked for changes such as establishing guidelines for the proper use of the fund, guidelines that could be used by the funeral service establishments and funeral service practitioners, as well as guidelines that could be shared with the consumer to help the consumer understand what the fund is really about and how it is to be used. I've also asked for detailed procedures, including requirements for preparing reimbursement applications by the funeral service establishments and practitioners. I've also asked for regulatory oversight that would ensure the proper use of the fund and eliminate abuse of the fund. One of the primary requests that I've had over the many years is for us to be able to establish some consistency for the use of the fund. I have some estimates for you that I prepared that how I would see the fund playing out in 2015. There will be roughly 34,000 deaths in Oregon this year. Death certificate filing fees that we collect from the consumer and turn over to the DHS, now hopefully Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board, will total approximately $200,000 that would be placed into this fund. That's for the course of a year. And that money is then distributed to funeral service practitioners for reimbursement for dispositions or for indigent services. I would expect that this year there will be just over 400 reimbursement applications that will be submitted by funeral service establishments. That mathematically would tell us that the reimbursements will be roughly $450 each. That's not unlike what it has been for 2014. I have some actual numbers from my own company for 2014 that I can share with you. My company as a whole used the indigent reimbursement fund 94 times in 2014. Our actual reimbursements ranged from $218 to $650. You can see there's a vast canyon there. So when we file for an application for reimbursement, we have no knowledge of how much the reimbursement will actually be. And that can be sometimes kind of frustrating for us. The average reimbursement for our company this past year, 2014, was $468. Our average aging report time was 63 days, but the high was 153 days and the low was 28 days. So the consistency would be not that we're seeking would not only be for a more specific amount that we would expect, but a more consistency aging report, more consistent aging report. Based on my company's position in the greater community, I've accepted our role of assisting those who need a little extra help, and we will continue to do so. It would be nice to know, in turn, that we have the cooperation and support of that same greater community. This legislation would create a needed change in management of this fund and would allow us, the death care industry, to work closely with the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board and address each and every one of these issues very effectively. Thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you. I appreciate the testimony.
Chair Holden, may I add one?
Okay. Go ahead.
I think it's important to note how the fund works and why there is the variation in 1 month you might receive $200 or you might receive $100 or you might get the cap of $650. And that is because each month that fund is zeroed out. The death certificate filing fee, a portion of that goes into the fund, and then depending on how many of those filing fees are collected in any particular month, then and depending on how many applications to the fund there are, then that money is divided out on that fund and it's zeroed out every month. So you might receive a smaller amount or you might receive the cap just depending on the number of applications in each month. And that's why Randy in his comments was talking about the variation and why we're looking for some consistency in that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So was it a previous legislature that came up with that great formula?
I believe so, yes, sir.
We could have done
I'm new. That. I'm new, Mr. Chair. It wasn't me.
I was hoping that. I'm hoping it was at least 12 years ago.
Exactly.
So, I thank you so much for your testimony. You know, I will comment. We have, you know, several bills in this still in this committee. Some we heard almost from the very beginning of February. We're still working on and intend to. And get accomplished before our time runs out. So to put some of you at rest, we do take these issues seriously, and we will be, you know, working them and trying to come up with a good solution this time, maybe better than last. But it's going to take your help to help us get there. So I appreciate that, and I'm sure we'll be having some more conversations on the issue. Thank you so much for bringing us such a hot topic.
Thank you, and, Mr. Chair.
A lively discussion.
Yeah, a lively discussion, yeah. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3243. And we will open a work session on House Bill 2969. Jan, can you remind us what this bill's about? Hopefully it's a cheery subject.
Yes, this is the bill that Representative Post came to the committee and talked about last week. It allows the on-premise consumption of food and non-alcoholic beverages at certified smoke shops as long as that food and beverage is not sold or offered by the shop. It declares an emergency. There are no amendments. There's no revenue impact. There is a minimal fiscal impact.
Would you like a motion, Mr. Chair?
If you think it's appropriate to give me a motion on this bill, I'm happy to take it.
Mr. Chair, this bill is going to Ways and Means, correct? I was just kidding. No. It was a joke. I'm sorry. I know Representative Post is watching. I just want to.
Well, I'm surprised he's not here to prevent his bill from, you know.
He's watching on TV.
I
wish I could have seen it. Okay, it's going to the floor. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2969 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 2969 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there discussion about the bill?
You will learn.
Seeing none.
Here's your text.
I was a little bit worried about this bill moving forward, and, you know, still have some apprehension because I missed the public hearing, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to take it upon my committee that deems this a great bill to bring forward. So with that, Matthew, would you give us a vote? Oh, Representative Evans, a comment?
I'm not classifying this as a great bill.
Okay. Further discussion.
Are we making smokers obese with this bill?
Yeah. There is a motion on the floor.
Perhaps
a motion.
I call the question.
Yeah, I think it's time we need to call the question.
Okay, before it goes further downhill. So, as not to make Representative Post nervous, Matthew, can you give us a roll call vote?
Representative
Beretta? He's excused.
Yes.
Representative Escobar?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Representative Fagan?
Aye.
Representative Hurd?
He's excused.
Representative
Nose?
Aye.
Representative
Weiser? Aye.
Vice Chair Martin?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenneman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Holder?
That would be an aye. With that, House Bill 2969 is required, has passed with the required votes. And moves to the floor. And who would like to carry this bill?
Host, I assume. We might ask.
Are you sure? Okay, we'll take
it. Kenny Geyer, I think.
Oh, nice. Well played.
Perhaps we can extend courtesy to former Representative Tomei.
Yeah, maybe we'll
bring a courtesy of the floor.
Well played. Okay, well played.
Well, we'll see if Representative Post can bring this bill home. So with that, we will have him carry it on the floor, and we'll close the work session, House Bill 2969. And with that, we hope for your listening pleasure, we will close the House Committee on Business and Labor.